Good morning, Allison.
How are you, Carl?
I'm doing fine. Welcome to my podcast, A Life in Biography.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, yes. And I think the first thing we'll do is make sure on the pronunciation of your last name.
It's Maycor.
I thought so. Yeah, that's the way I've been saying it, but I didn't want to embarrass myself.
Oh, no, thank you for checking. A lot of people want to make me Scottish and say Macor, but
Oh yeah.
it's Czech. So,
Oh, okay, very, very good. We're going to be talking about your book, Making the Best Years of Our Lives, the Hollywood classic that inspired a nation. But before we get into some details about the book, about yourself and how you came to write this book.
well, this is my third book. I was telling somebody the other day that, I didn't grow up watching movies. My family wasn't really into that. My parents didn't take us to a lot of movies. But I really came to film history in college. And I was really inspired. I had great young professors, and I was so inspired by them. I decided toward the end of college that I wanted to also teach film history. So that led me to the University of Texas, where I got my master's and my PhD. And when I started my PhD, I also simultaneously got an offer to be a local film critic. And that really, I think, sort of dictated my path. As much as I love teaching, and learning and being a perpetual grad student, I did not feel completely comfortable in academia, and especially with the sort of typical style of academic writing. I was lucky enough to have professors there like Tom Schatz, Charles Ramirez Berg, big names in film studies, who gave me sort of a model for how to do, public-facing scholarship, really. And that inspired me. So as I was finishing my dissertation, I was working sort of on this side project, which at the time was going to be a biography of a woman in contemporary filmmaking. I don't want to say too much about it because I wasn't able to write it. I'd still like to. This person is still alive and a little bit resistant to being written about. So, anyway, I'm biding
Well,
my
that's
tongue.
intriguing.
Yes. But then I was, as I said, I was a film critic, and a lot was happening in Austin with the film scene. Richard Linklater's, Slacker was having its 10th anniversary at the time. This is around 2001. Spy Kids by Robert Rodriguez was coming out. There's just a lot going on. And so I decided to write my first book about that sort of rise of the independent film scene in Austin. My second book was a biography of the screenwriter and script doctor Warren Skarin, who people probably don't know his name, but he was the final writer on Top Gun and Beetlejuice, Batman, Beverly Hills Cop 2, before he died tragically at the age of 44. So when it came time to think about my next book, I'd always loved The Best Years of Our Lives. I saw it probably when I was getting my master's and was just blown away by its freshness, its relevance, really. And my students, I worked it into almost every class I taught, because I was like, yeah, okay, film noir, horror, independent film, it's very versatile. And my students really warmed to it as well. And I kept thinking, as beloved as it is, and I write this in the book, I argue that I just don't think the average person really knows this film. And I wanted to write about it because I thought it was still relevant. And I had always been intrigued by what it had to say about war trauma, which is, what we call PTSD today. And lucky enough to my publisher, ET Press, was interested. And so I started it around 2018, and finished it April of 2020. So right during lockdown, right as lockdown.
It's one of the things I like about the book is it is historical. You really give a sense of the time in which the movie was being made. You mentioned Tom Schatz, who I don't know, but didn't he write a history of the Hollywood studio system?
He wrote Genius of the System, which
That's
is,
it, Genius
yeah,
of the System.
it's amazing. Again, a book that so many people know, not just in academia, because Tom's writing is so accessible and so smart. And yeah, I aspire to that. I'm not a fan of doing away completely with endnotes or footnotes. I know that's sort of a trend. So I think it's, I think it's also helpful. For instance, when I was lucky enough to use your bio of Dana Andrews, and it's like that's how you do scholarship, right? You read other people's work, you sort of follow the paper trail for what you're working on. And yes, so Tom is a friend, he just retired, and he was a supporter of this book. And yeah, it's really great to have people like that in your corner.
I'm looking at the notes to your book as we speak, since you mentioned them, and they're quite detailed. It's well documented. And the trick is, I think, with writing this book, or really almost any book, is to know how to use all that documentation and write it in a way that's accessible. Your book is, I would call your book scholarly, but by that I don't mean it's only for scholars. I simply mean that your approach, your detailed approach, your sense of history, the way you present the background of the film is really important. It's the kind of thing I try to do in my work on Hollywood biography as well, which is, when I started reading your book, this was before it was published, I just couldn't stop.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, because it is a narrative. It's about the life stories of these people. I think that certain people in the book, like Samuel Goldwyn, who people tend to make fun of because of his Goldwynisms, include me out,
Yes.
and his Dana Andrews loved to make fun of his ac of Goldwyn's accent,
Yeah.
but he's part of the genius of the system.
Exactly. I mean, he took a risk with this film. And I think everybody who worked on it really took a risk. But yeah, Goldwyn is important, and I had to access his material, and you probably know this at the Herrick, his collection. I mean, I had to request access. It's not an open collection, so I was like, oh God, what if I can't get into this? So it was very exciting to be able to get into it and sit down and just go through. I know you can relate to this because of the books you write, that feeling of sitting down with the material and reading letters and reading memos. It's just, I don't know. It's my happy place for sure.
Well, it's wonderful and it's eye-opening. When I was working on my Walter Brennan biography, I was at University of Southern California in their archive collection, and I was looking at Sergeant York because Brennan is in that, along with, of course, Gary Cooper, and I came across this whole even sometimes the stuff you can't use specifically in the book, but it gives you such a sense of, again, how something got made. I mean,
Yeah.
how difficult it was to get Alvin York to finally consent to do, he was a World War I hero, but the movie's not made till World War II. Why did it take so long? Well, if you go into the archive, you understand how the producers, really had to work on this guy and assure him, that this was going to be done seriously and sensibly, before it could get made. So I think, yeah, I think the, I think that's, again, one of the strengths of your book is that it draws on primary source material. It's really important. The
Thank
other thing that I wanted to say, and you can comment on this if you like, is think of it this way. William Wyler, the director, was worried because he was being told, including by Robert Sherwood, who wrote the script, you know, that by the time this film gets out, it's going to be out of date. People aren't going to be interested in returning veterans from World War II. But imagine this, somebody says, hey, there's this blank verse novel by McKinley Cantor. Wouldn't that make a great movie?
And it is so funny to me. And this is the thing, right? You put your book or whatever your creative project out into the world, and it definitely takes on a life of its own, as this is already doing. And I've seen a few people say, like, well, you know, sort of defending Cantor's book, and I thought, well, gosh, I'm not saying it's a bad book. I'm just saying that, you know, for the average person, it may not be their first point of entry into the story, you know. And Goldwyn had that skill, I think, in saying, okay, I asked you to write this book and you did, and there's some good material here. And he even, you know, Cantor even took a first pass at it as a screenplay. I think he did the outline, if I write, you know, whatever I say in the book. And but it had to be, it really had to be, I think, rounded off a little bit. The bitterness had to be weighed with a little bit more optimism, I think, especially at that period. You know, it's the film ends with a wedding, and I think there's a reason for that. I think the evidence I found made me think, and I've heard this before, I could never track down the actual document, you know, that I wanted to find that had Wyler saying, I really think maybe we should end with the scene in the bomber graveyard. But I definitely got the feeling that he was leaning that way at one point, you know, writing to Sherwood and saying, basically, you know, what do you think? What should I do? And Sherwood kind of, you know, was moving on to a new project and was sort of like, you're on your own right now. So, yeah.
Yeah, I as I say in my review of your book in the New York Sun, it really is a group biography. You just get this really rich, wonderful account of the interaction between the screenwriter Robert Sherwood and Wyler the director, and what the actors are doing with their part, and you know Goldwyn, who Wyler often didn't get along with.
Yeah.
Nevertheless, was a huge, supporter of this film. The way the story is told, I think, is really important. I read a comment on Facebook the other day about someone who's saying it's really a sad story for veterans, and that brought me up short. Not because there isn't sadness in the film, but I don't see the best years of our lives as a sad film. There are some very grim elements and sad parts of it, but it seems to me that it's so much more than calling it a sad story.
I agree. I mean, people have been asking me why, if you know, if you're saying that this film is not as widely known today as, say, It's a Wonderful Life, which I write about in the book, you know, because it came out just within weeks of this and didn't do as well initially as this film. You know, why do you think that is? And I said, well, maybe it's because, you know, we're so fractured about war today. And I want to be very careful, and you know, I'm not trying to gloss over that there were differences, saying there were no differences in 1946. Obviously there were, and there was unrest for sure. But I think that might be one of the reasons. But there was this sense, you know, everybody had been touched by this war in one way or another. And I think that was maybe the unifying factor. And I think this film speaks to that because it is about the three veterans, but it's also about, you know, their loved ones' experiences as well. You know, I use the story of Willie and Tally's relationship. I didn't go into this project thinking, oh, you know, I'm going to write this much about them, but I found their letters in, you know, the one of the collections, and I spent a whole day at the Margaret Herrick Library a good chunk of a day reading them start to finish, just to get a sense of, what was this for both of them. And it's funny, I just got an email this morning from one of the Wyler siblings. In my mind, they're the Wyler kids, but they're way beyond that now. And I was nervous because, you're writing about real people and you're
That's
writing
right.
about their relationship and their intimacies. And I thought, oh God, how's this going to go over? But at least, one of the four so far really liked it.
Yeah, that's always kind of nerve-wracking. What
It is so nerve-wracking.
family's going to think. You know, I interviewed Tally Weiler.
Oh, really?
Yes, I interviewed her for my Lillian Hellman biography because she's
Okay,
a friend
yes.
of Hellman's, and Hellman stayed with her toward the end of Hellman's life. I sure wish I knew the things that I know now from reading your book. You know, I would have asked her about a whole bunch of other things. We didn't really talk that much about her husband, but you know, he, along with Goldman, is kind of a hero of your book.
I really, as I said, I wanted to write the biography of the film. That's kind of where I started. And in order to write about a film, you have to write about the people who made it and who worked on it. And I didn't start out thinking this story is going to be about mainly these three people, Wyler, Russell, Harold Russell, and Sam Goldwyn. But that's sort of how it developed. And because I really wanted to these sort of investigator trace these origins of PTSD through this movie. That second chapter where I write about that was the first thing I wrote after the intro, because I knew, I went in knowing very little about the history of PTSD, and I knew it was going to be very hard to write. So I got the PTSD and I thought, well, you can't just sort of stop your narrative and dump all this history. So how am I going to do this? And that's when slowly I was able to, start with Russell's story because I figured people knew about him the least. And then when I really started to do like a chronology for him and when he was injured and when Willie was injured during World War II, I realized there was such overlap. And then I was fascinated to find that, even in that brief year that between the two of their injury between their injuries, sort of how much was in flux in terms of how the military treated war trauma. That fascinated me.
Yeah, that's still a problem today in some respects, I think. Very much so. What you said earlier about the audience for this film and it's not being as well known to say It's a Wonderful Life. It's a curious thing about what people consider well known or ignored, you know, or underrated. I don't think the best years of our lives has ever been underrated. When you talk about how well known the film is, if you go online and you look at the Facebook pages, the groups devoted to Dana Andrews, for example, the power that this film has over what might be called a niche or a niche audience is tremendous. I don't know if that's true for It's a Wonderful Life or not. It's a film that everybody knows, but I don't know. I haven't investigated whether it has that same kind of intense following. I mean, that's what I discovered with my Dana Andrews biography is when I proposed it to University Press of Mississippi, I thought, well, take it because he certainly was a star, especially in the 1940s. But how many people are going to read this book? You know, I once said to a Hollywood agent who I met at a biographer's conference, would you have bought a book like this? He said, absolutely not. And that he wouldn't have bought it, but I mean, could you sell it to a publisher, a trade house? And he said, no, I couldn't. And yet that book, Dana Andrews, does as well as my Sylvia Plath biography because the audience is so committed.
I know. It is a curious thing, and I do. That's a good point. That there are different audiences, right? And because
Yeah.
I wanted this to have a bit of, a wider reach, I was definitely thinking, general public. I mean, then you've got the movie fans. You've got sort of the military audience, perhaps, for this book. But, what's the general public's relationship to this movie? And I guess that's where I see I hope a connection can be made. I hope, like, we had an event here in Austin, Memorial Day, a screening. It was really fun. And a guy came up to me up at the end, and he's veteran, but a recent veteran, and he had just read about it in the paper or online and came, and loved it and couldn't believe he hadn't heard about the film before. So, like, that's what I guess hopeful about,
Well,
as much as I wrote this for the fans of the film, which I did because I'm one, I also wrote it to bring new people to it, I hope.
yeah, it's still so relevant. The whole issue with the character that Harold Russell plays, Homer Parrish, his prosthetics, that scene where he shows what's her
Wilma.
name, Kathy O'Donnell, Wilma. When he shows, because he's so worried about his disability and that he's not a whole man, so to speak, and therefore no woman is going to love him. And he finally, in a sense, breaks down and lets her in this incredibly intimate scene where he shows her how he, in a sense, straps on his arms. It's incredible.
It is. And I think, that's why that's one of my, that's probably my favorite scene, or right up there with another one. And it's a sequence, right? Because it's really, it's a while. It starts in the kitchen, it ends in the bedroom. And to me, there is just so much going on with the lighting, the composition, the acting. I write about it in the book. I say it's one of the film's most important sequences, and it's, Wyler had to work with the least experienced, actors on the movie for this scene. So it was a real, he was really careful with it and patient with them.
It's hard to watch, but you can't look away.
Yeah, my students, definitely, it's, you hold your breath as they go up the stairs because it's like, which way is this going to go?
It's not predictable
No.
what's going to happen. I just have to mention, you can tell I'm a fan of the film too. When the Frederick March character, Al Stevenson, comes home
Yeah.
and he comes in, his wife doesn't realize that he's back yet. When Myrna Loy turns around, wow,
Yeah.
the look on her face.
And the quaver, I forget how to say
Yeah,
that word,
the
in her
quaver, yeah.
is so, yeah, it's all of a piece. I mean, it's just, you can even see through her blouse, kind of how her back, sort of tenses, and it's an amazing moment. And this, I know. But listeners may not, that was very much inspired by Willie and Tally's reunion at a hotel, when he had to leave and came back briefly for, I think, a couple months. He was working on the Memphis Belle documentary. And I mean, I had heard the story. I had heard that that was inspired by that. But when I started to read, the telegrams where he was sort of telling her, "Meet me at this hotel. Don't bring the children," I was just like, "Wow, this is the moment,"
Well, he had lost his hearing and was really worried about how he would be able to work. And your book will explain to readers how he was able to work and did recover some of his hearing. But he obviously identified with characters like Homer Parrish, the real character, because he had the same worries. He had experienced so much. He had literally been deafened by war. And now he had to adjust to peacetime. The other scene I mentioned in my New York Sun review is Dana Andrews, his character, Fred Derry, coming home. The shot of his parents, the interiors, is just shocking. It's almost like they're living in a hen house. I mean, they have so little. And here's a guy who was a soda jerk, who then has this, amazing, really, experience in the war, as a bombardier, and then having to come back. And what does he do? How does he adjust? That's a film in itself.
Yeah, it really is, because I think you get the sense from that character. I mean, we start with him, right? The film starts with, and you get the sense that he's initially hopeful and, ready and like, okay, my upward trajectory during the war is going to translate to my new career as a civilian, and it just doesn't happen. And the scene in the drugstore where Peggy comes in, I love that scene. It's so chaotic with the kid, that awful child, and the woman buying the perfume with her hat. There's just so much going on, and he's remains dignified through it, even though he's very approachable at the same time. It's really something to watch him on screen.
It's one of his Dane Andrews's great roles, and like Wyler, although Dane Andrews was not in the war, did not serve
Right.
in uniform, he made it a point to know veterans, to know what was going on, to really study them in a sense. So in that way, he was really prepared for the film. The
Well,
other thing that, yeah, go ahead. Yeah, sorry.
I would go as far as to say that, his own situation, having lost his wife and being a single parent, even though, he had tremendous help. I mean, I think that gave him a certain kind of depth, that, he could just bring as a human being to his roles.
I think that's so. Yeah, I think that. Again, as your book shows, who these people were who made this film is so intimately related to the film that's being made, to the characters they're playing, to the way the action is directed. It's all such of a piece.
Yeah, I felt like I had so much to work with. And, you talk about the scene with his dad and Hortense. I love how, is it Roman Bonin says, Hortense, Hortense. I wanted to do more. There are places where I wanted to do more, and it's a slim book, but at the same time, there you still have to make cuts, and kind of bring it together. So, I'm sure there's going to be somebody who would want more about that. I know somebody was saying to me, "Well, what about, the set direction?" I'm like, "Well, I write about the set direction." Sometimes there's only so much you can say before you're
Yeah, that's right. Some college scholar's going to say, "Well, I want to hear more about deep focus."
right. know it's it, but that's writing. That's, as you make choices. It's really
Yeah,
all.
you have to select. Yeah. Something else that somebody said about the film, which I think is true but also isn't true, it was called sentimental. Now, again, it is and it isn't. The Al Stevenson character is interesting. Frederick March, he's a banker. He's middle class, upper middle class. He's coming back to a job in the bank, and he runs into a little bit of trouble because he wants to give loans to veterans who don't have collateral. And for him, their collateral is their experience. You know, he understands where they're coming from. And yet at the same time, he doesn't really want Fred Derry, the Dana Andrews character, to marry his daughter. It's, you know, it's interesting. You know, we're back at home. We're no longer in war. He understands the war. The world has changed, and yet in some ways he's changed, in some ways he hasn't.
Well, I think in that opening, that sequence where he goes back, where he returns home, Al returns home, and he's trying to interact with his son, Rob, and with Peggy. And I think you get these clues that he really just is having trouble processing that they've grown up. I guess that's how I read, partly read his reticence, but also, Dana Andrews' character Fred is married.
Yeah,
And
that's a problem.
that's a problem. And he says, Peggy, how are you gonna do? How are you gonna break that marriage up? When she says that, he's like, "You're gonna do it with an axe?" I mean, so for as real, as his relationship is with Millie, Myrna Loy's character, and I mean real in the sense that it's awkward in the beginning, and they're readjusting to one another. You can tell that he's got perhaps, I don't know, I don't want to call old fashioned, but definitely a very kind of societally rooted sense of what marriage is, and that you just don't dispense with it kind of thing. That's what I've always taken away from his character.
That makes sense. It's such a it gives you such a sense of it's not a documentary, and yet it's not biography per se, but it's a combination of all those elements that people responded to. I was saying at the beginning, there was all this doubt about would people go to see this film. Boy, did they go to see this film.
Yeah, I mean, for about 10 years, it was second to only Gone with the Wind in terms of, box office grosses. And then it set all kinds of records overseas, particularly in London. And I loved reading those reviews too. The London reviews, they're praising the film while at the same time they're totally dissing Americans. It's hilarious. And
That's a very common attitude then, yeah.
I know,
A
and I
lot of
just
resentment,
it was just so funny to read. Like, and going back to your point about sentimentality, it was like, well, it was made in the United States, so of course it's sentimental, but it also has this, so.
It's interesting too. This film really is stands by itself, and by that I mean go and try to do this again. For the Korean War, and he couldn't quite, and he used some of the same people. He used Dana Andrews again, who was under contract to Goldwyn. I've forgotten the title of that film.
I want you.
I Want You. Thank you. It's better than mine.
Just
And it's,
it's
I
all
think it's
about.
an interesting film, but it simply doesn't have the epic quality. Films aren't novels, and yet The Best Years of Our Lives comes very close to what novels can do in terms of narrative and depth of character. I think this is where, in fact, filmmaking and biography come together. When you can talk about deep focus simply as a technique, but what we've got here is deep focus on the characters. At the same time, we have depth of character.
Yeah. I mean, Wyler, that was really top of mind for him. He wanted to keep all of the stories, he used the word alive, going. And so it was a real, working that out in post-production with Daniel Mandel, the editor, was pretty crucial, trimming the scenes exactly, getting them timed right, choosing the takes. I've always been fascinated in the post-production process, the editing process in particular. So it was really fun to read about sort of how that took shape.
I've forgotten how long the film is, but it's close to 3 hours.
It is. It's like 172 minutes, I believe. Yeah.
That was also a big risk. I mean, unless you're dealing with Gone with the Wind, and there you have an intermission, and you have it's not based on a blank verse novel. Gone with the Wind was a huge,
Right.
the
Usually
novel was a huge success. That was the built-in success right there, and then you get Clark Gable, and my God, how can you miss? Best Years of Our Lives, and right after the war, It might very well be, not only does Robert Sherwood say it's out, it's going to be out of date, it's like, well, maybe people just want to forget about the war,
Right.
and get on with it. So the film is going to seem somehow irrelevant. But again, whether you've been through war or not, I can just imagine that, current veterans watching this. I mentioned the scene with the prosthetics. I mean, just the idea of coming home, and wondering about how people are going to respond to you. This film deals with that over and over again.
It does. I mean, it was inspired initially by a two-page article in Time magazine called, I think The Way Home. And that article just so deftly captured through quotes of the soldiers on the troop train, how they felt, what their worries were. And that it's fascinating to me that, from that article that Frances Goldwyn, Sam's wife, first read and brought to his attention, through to the finished film on the screen, you really do get that preserved, that sense of fear among these characters. How will I be perceived?
I wonder if there's enough material to do a book on Frances Goldwyn. She was really important to him.
She really was. And I had more about her in the book, but
I know
had.
you have to, yeah.
Yeah, but she is very fascinating. Her friendship with her long friendship with George Cukor, and just her role, I think, in Samuel Goldwyn Productions. What
So, yeah.
she had to put up with by being
Yes.
married to Samuel.
I was gonna say, there are biographers listening to this podcast, and I'm giving you a freebie here. Frances Goldwyn, look it up, see what you could do with it. I say that because I was recently reminded of her. I'm doing a book called William Faulkner Day by Day, an effort to find out what he did on every day of his life. And of course, the book is a failure because I can't find out about every day. God knows how long it would be if I found out about every day. But Faulkner, who is, notorious for being uncomfortable in Hollywood and disliking it and this and that and the other, which it's a more complex story than that, but that's the story I think that most people know. And he goes to a party, which is also rare. He hated to go to parties. And at one of these parties, he meets Frances Goldwyn. And he never, even when he goes to party, he doesn't write about them. He doesn't keep a journal. He doesn't keep a diary. But he writes home and he says, I met Frances Goldwyn, and he's very impressed.
What impressed him about her?
I think her intelligence, her ability to meet him and talk to him, and relate to him. So many people just wanted to, if they knew he was a writer, they wanted his autograph, or they wanted to pitch him something, or just wanted to talk to somebody who's famous. But Frances Goldwyn, of course, was dealing with stars and important people all the time. And I think, and this is just my inference as a Faulkner biographer, I just think there was a meeting of minds there.
Well, her relationship with Virginia Mayo was interesting to me. She kind of
Oh yeah, say something about that.
took her under her wing, when Goldwyn flew to New York to see Mayo in she was in a Billy Rose's review, I think, on Broadway. And just the way she like this the, I don't know if I put this in the book, but she would sometimes give Mayo rides to the parties. She would go get her for the parties at the Goldwyn's house, which is kind of interesting. And I guess she sh like drove kind of a beater car. I don't know. And Virginia Mayo, when she first saw it, was sort of surprised, like, this is the car that Sam Goldwyn's wife is driving. So that was kind of interesting to me. And I want to say, I could be wrong about this, but I feel like she. Did Frances Goldwyn have some connection? Yes, she used to date William Paley, is that right? Or
That could be, I don't remember. Yeah, but that could well be. Yeah.
like she might have been mentioned by Truman Capote in the, I don't know. I think there's some connection there too.
Yeah. Well, it's just getting more interesting by the all the time. Someone needs to write this up.
That's right. You're both, yeah, we're both doing someone a favor.
Yeah, exactly.
Send us
So
advanced
put
copies when it's done.
advance copies and put us in the footnotes.
That's right.
So what else should I have asked you about your book? I've been expressing my enthusiasm, but there may be things you want to say that I haven't asked you about.
I mean, I think I just, I'm very grateful for your interest, and I'm so glad that it reads the way it does for you, because that was important to me, to really sort of tell the story of this film and make it a story, rather than a history, in the sort of conventional sense that we think of it, I guess. I think when people hear the word history, they go, oh, it's going to be work.
Yes.
But I know, I'm pretty sure you and I don't feel that way, but sometimes you have to package it a certain way. It seems like people are finding the book, and I'm excited about that. It was just, a time and a place. We were talking earlier about, why may the film not be as well known to the general public? I mean, it definitely was a time and a place, and as you pointed out with the remake, I Want You, it was hard to duplicate that. And what and Goldwyn even released the film again in the end of the Korean War, Korean conflict, and it did okay in terms of re-releases, but it wasn't any big, it didn't make the splash he had hoped it would. And I think that sort of goes to that point a little bit, maybe that, things had started to change. And so you couldn't duplicate that success again in that way.
Right, yeah. This, I think you describe a unique combination of circumstances and people and timing and so on,
But
all worked out.
I want to make the point that's different from saying, though, the film can still be relevant, because I wrote about the film and its relevance for the Washington Post for Memorial Day, in their Made by History blog, and I talk about the retired Army major, Jeremy Haynes, I believe his name is, who introduced the film for Turner Classic Movies last Veterans Day last year. And he really spoke to, he was in Afghanistan. He came home a paraplegic, and he spoke to how the film, helped him in some way, how he could relate to the struggles of the characters. And when I, listened to his introduction, I thought, what better argument for this film still being relevant than listening to a current veteran say, this still speaks to me.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's been great speaking to you.
Thank you. You too. You were one of the very first people to reach out about it. And I always joke to friends, when you see an email in your inbox that says your book, you're always like, oh God, which way go? So I've, it's been really nice getting to sort of talk to you over email all these months.
Good, that's great. Well, I'm going to be posting this link, and I'll send a link to you, and you can send it to whoever you like.
Terrific. I would be happy to share it for sure.
Thanks, Allison.
Oh, thanks so much, Carl. Take care.
You too. Bye bye.
Bye-bye.
Good morning, Peter.
Good morning, Carl. How are you?
I'm doing fine, and I hope you are too.
I woke up today, so yes, I'm doing fine.
That's my feeling too.
Yeah.
Welcome again to my podcast, A Life in Biography. I'm speaking with Peter K. Steinberg, co-editor of the Letters of Sylvia Plath. We're going to be talking about letters. Before I say anything else, I want to tell you that this podcast is being brought to you on location. What that means is I'm on my back porch, my screened-in porch. So you may hear some bird song. If you start to hear lawn equipment, I'll be moving inside.
Okay.
But so far, so good.
Okay.
So I got to thinking about letters, not just Sylvia Plath's letters, but just letters. And one of my pet peeves is additions of selected letters. I understand it's in terms of just the economics of publishing, to publish all of the letters is a big lift for some publishers, even when the author of those letters is quite popular. Often it's a university press like Cambridge University Press. They're going to do 17 volumes of Ernest Hemingway's letters.
Wow.
Something like 6,000 letters, you know, very carefully annotated and so on. And that's being done for other canonical authors as well. I thought it'd be interesting in terms of your own experience and my experience as a plath biographer to talk about the letters and sort of the history of the letters. We can get into all sorts of things, whatever you want to talk about. But, you know, for many years, either the biographers went to archives or they relied on the edition of letters home. Mm-hmm. And that was problematic. When I did American Isis, The Life and Art of Sylvia Plath, when I saw that this was heavily edited, and then when I looked in the archive and I saw that all kinds of things were being taken out, the first thing I did is I went to Lilly Library and I wanted to look at all those letters that weren't in Letters Home. Mm-hmm. For all sorts of reasons. So maybe you could just talk a little bit about, people wonder why there have been so many biographies of Plath. And part of it is, not the only reason, but part of it is because of the way the access to materials have been delayed, I guess I would say.
Yeah, I read Letters Home approximately one time in full in the late 90s when I first started to read Plath, and I was not happy with the book. I didn't feel like I was getting anything out of it. I didn't feel like I was really getting the same sort of persona, you know, this I mean, it's a vibrant book in respects that it's a positive, there's a positivity to the letters, but it just wasn't fulfilling. And in the same ways, it's like the original 1982 edition of the journals that was abridged.
Yes, and yeah. In both cases, I mean, you may want to talk about this. How letters get published, whether they're selected and sometimes even not just selected, but expurgated or parts of them are left out.
Right.
That readers really need to be aware of that.
They're
getting, you know, a truncated view.
Yeah, and I don't really remember really Plath's excessively long introduction to Letters Home very well. Again, I read it once and that was it. I didn't find it very useful. But I don't recall there being any sort of direct and explicit explanation of how the letters were presented. And, you know, there are a lot of ellipses, but you don't really know if they are the editor's or if they're Plath's own. When I was editing her letters, I noticed that she used them quite frequently. And I would periodically like dip into parts of Letters Home. And sure enough, you know, sometimes the ellipses do indicate cut text, and sometimes they do actually mirror Plath's own use of them. So it's a little confusing to read Letters Home. And by virtue of the fact that book was simply letters to her mother and her brother and a few other people, you really don't get the way that Plath interacted with other people, friends, for example, even other relatives, business associates, such as the people at the BBC or Harper's Magazine, The New Yorker, and so on. When you read them sort of all in full and in chronological order, or at least when you have access to them and you're able to dip around and use the index, which Letters Home lacked, you just get a fuller sense of who she was as a person and how she interacted with people and the nature of the relationships that she had with people, which they were all very distinctive and unique relationships. But when it comes to the selecting of the letters, that was something that Karen and I really were sort of on the same page about, is we're doing everything. We're not going to be selecting letters out. We're only going to be including everything that we could get. And
It's just her approach in the to the journals was the same thing, to print everything.
right. And that's sort of, it's obviously better. And I mean, it is a greater expense for whatever publishing houses are going to bring these books out, but it's definitely worth it because you get everything up to that point. And then maybe in the future with the additional letters that I've found or that might still come to light, there might be an instance then that you can do a selected and new letters, kind of like a poet would do a selected and new poetry book.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Because you still have you would still have the access to the full volume such as they existed, but you recognize that some of the letters are might be a little weaker, and then you can present the stronger letters plus the new letters, and let the readers of Plath still have access to everything if they so desire.
That's a good idea. It's like a biography, a two volume or more volume biography, and then coming out with the condensed, version, because the biographer knows, well, it's all there. If you want to see, what I left out in the condensed version, it's easily accessible. So that makes a lot of sense. Now, what happens after Letters Home? How do we get to this huge two volume edition of Plath's letters that you and Karen Kuchel did?
Yeah, so I think what happened is and this, I'm not making a joke, just time happened. And I understand Letters Home because it was a sort of reaction, if you will, to the Bell Jar and to some of the negative press that Mrs. Plath felt like she was getting. Although I think, I don't know if this is a digression or this is unpopular, but I actually don't find the portrayal of the mother to be very bad in the Bell Jar. Plath herself even says in the libel letter to James Mitchie that she sent in November of 1961 that she doesn't really portray the mother badly. It is the beastly daughter. I think she uses the word beastly even, that, because she's sick, she's not seeing the world or its people in sort of not the right way, but in a normal way, for lack of a better way to put it.
Well, I think that's a really vital point. The novel is almost a kind of dramatic monologue, the way she wrote Plath wrote some dramatic monologues, and they're not just Plath. They're an assumed voice. They're a creation.
And it was a voice of a person who is unwell. And I think that's important to recognize when you read it. And if you want to, I do, I'll admit it to you, but no one else, that I do read the Bell Jar autobiographically. I know full well that there are parts that have been rearranged chronologically, but for the most part, it is very much obviously based on real events. Only the names have been changed,
Well,
and
needless to,
some of them rather badly. But anyway, so I think a lot of things had to happen before we got to the point in time where a fuller version of the letters could come out, and that was the biggest one is that Ted Hughes had to pass away. Really, a Plath had to pass away, and it's a shame that these people had to die, but it happens to everybody. And with things like the unabridged journals coming out and the restored edition of Ariel coming out, it seemed like it was just a matter of time before the estate of Sylvia Plath and the publishers of Sylvia Plath realized that they needed to issue the fuller versions of things like her letters and her poems, which is in progress. So, those are things that they needed to happen, but they couldn't happen until a certain amount of time passed. And that it's interesting, the history of publishing Plath is fascinating because you get all the individual collections, and then you don't necessarily get a biography first. You get letters home that preceded Edward Boucher's book, and then you get the poems and the journals in back-to-back years. So it's just very interesting to see how they initially, and I forgot Johnny Panic came out in 77. So you get this sort of piecemeal release of some of this stuff, and it builds into bigger collections and whatnot. And so it took 42 years for Letters Home to be replaced by that first volume of letters. It took 18 years for the journals to be replaced. The poems came out in 81, and they're going to be, replaced in 2024. So I think it's just a time thing. And it's, I think the world is now in a different place where enough people who were mentioned in the letters, that there's no privacy concerns for them really, because they've passed away. And I think that makes a big difference.
Yeah, I think so too. And I think the other, one of the other factors in terms of time passing is Freda Hughes. I mean, she's had a long time to think about. She was very angry about some things that were written about her parents, especially her father. And she's to reckon with all that. This has been a process for her. And to some extent, she writes about that in your edition of the letters.
She does. And I think it's obviously wonderful that she is open about allowing these things to come out and to come out in full, and even with the really emotional stuff that is in them. I mean, the letters from Plath to Ted Hughes in Volume One are immensely emotional letters, just the same as the second volume letters to Dr. Boysher. It's a different kind of emotion, sort of the opposite of the Ted Hughes letters, but they're powerful and they're not easy reading. And for her as the daughter of these people to be, to read them and to allow access to them was generous, I found.
I think interesting point. The whole issue of privacy while people are alive. I've dealt with this all the time, especially when I've done biographies of living figures. And at the time when you're doing it, I'll just speak for myself, you upset some people. I upset some people with some of my books. But what I'm thinking about when I'm doing the book is I'm not just thinking about now. I'm thinking about later. I'm thinking about what people are going to make of all this later. And therefore, I've never been particularly persuaded. In fact, I've rejected that notion, well, you can't do this or you can't do that. Especially with biography, it's almost inevitable that you're going to hurt somebody's feelings. It's almost unavoidable. And yet, in the course of time, even some of those same people, when they have a chance to reflect and look back on it, come to terms with it in a way that they couldn't when either the letters or the biography or whatever it was originally published. So that I think that you really, and you do, you have this, you've just been describing it, you have this sense of time, of what it means over time, to ultimately get the full story. Now, there's something I've been dying to ask you, and you may not, journalists often do this. They ask a politician something that the politician really doesn't want to answer. But I am just really intrigued. Some of the letters that are in Letters Home are in private hands. And just someone saying, well, there must be this letter or that letter. I wonder who has it. Maybe you don't want to, maybe you're like the CIA and you don't want to divulge all sources and methods. But how do you get those letters?
Well, some of it is luck, There are letters that came to auction. I'm thinking particular of the letter to Catherine Bennion that w came to auction in I think December of 2018, and obviously that was after Volume 2 came out. But that letter came to auction. It was in private hands, and it was lucky enough that the entire letter was put online, so I was able to get images of it and transcribe it and include it in the paperback of the Faber edition as an appendix. Otherwise, I think for the most part in the main, sorry about the noise in the background there.
I thought I was going to be the problem on this.
Yeah, no, that was my alarm system, but that's okay. Yeah, so in volume in so in the volumes, the letters to Ted Hughes and to his parents, we put as private owner. And that was, I asked Frieda how she wanted those letters to be sort of the source of them to be acknowledged, because she knew how we were citing where everything was, and she said private owner was fine because at that time she didn't really want them associated with her. But they've since sold through the auction last summer. And otherwise, it was just reading Plath's letters, reading her diaries, her little pocket diaries that are at the Lilly Library, and her journals, and just noting down the people that she was writing, and then either writing them if they were still living, or writing to their next of kin if they had passed away. And the majority of the letters that I sent to people were, real letters with stamped addressed envelopes and whatnot, were unanswered. So either they don't have them, or they just weren't willing to play ball. But then in some instances, I hounded Melvin Woody for years about the letters that I knew he had. And he wrote at the 11th hour, right before Volume 1 was going to be submitted, to say that we could have the letters, and we got them, and then he ended up donating them to Smith. And the same thing happened with the letters to Ruth Freeman Geisler. I got in touch with her through Andrew Wilson, because he had talked to her for his biography, and she wrote back, and she was able, she was happy to share the letters with us, which she hadn't previously shared with anybody. And those subsequently also went to Smith College. So it actually worked out that I didn't have to anonymize really anybody other than the letters that we got from Frieda Hughes.
I see, yeah.
There was one letter included in the Frieda Hughes stuff that Frieda got right before she shared them with us. I'm not willing to divulge who had that.
Sure. Yeah,
But
understandable.
while I want to, because the person stole the letter, or had it
Oh.
seemingly stolenly, if I can invent a
Yeah.
word,
Yeah.
and I don't really respect that, I don't want to, I don't want to ruffle any feathers.
That's interesting. There's a history of at least alleged stealing in the Plath case, and Hughes and his sister Olwen did, I'll just say it, did, made a mess of it, and left things lying about. And we don't know, probably some people took things. It's almost, in a case like that, unavoidable that people just give into that temptation and take things. You mentioned Melvin Woody. It's interesting. You have the advantage over me in some cases, because I wrote to Melvin Woody many times, couldn't get him. I think it's different for some of these people anyway, dealing with an editor of letters, and someone like me, don't, for a whole variety of reasons. So my hat off to you. In getting this kind of material, which then I can use as a biographer.
Well, it's funny because I think even when he finally re he never responded to my queries, but when he finally did, if I remember correctly, I'm pretty sure he says, "I really didn't want to write you, but I think he had gotten to the point in his life where he was okay to let them go." And he readily admitted he would never read the book. He didn't believe in reading people's letters. But that he understood how, not, I mean, important's not a word I don't think he used, but I think he understood that they would fill in a really wonderful voice to the chorus of voices that Plath employs in these letters. And he wasn't wrong, or they do, they're wonderful letters. They're terrific.
And you could
And
see from the letters too that they had some wonderful conversations, which is why I wanted to interview him.
yeah, for sure. I was it's nice that he gave them to us, and he did participate in that Sylvia Plath Life Inside the Bell Jar documentary. I don't know if you saw that,
I
but
did. I'd forgotten that he had
yeah,
participated,
he
but
was
yeah.
in that. And I but I think those were that was like his last sort of I'll do this, but then he's just going to go back to his private life, which I totally get.
Right. Yeah. You mentioned the Faber paperback edition of the letters, and I wanted to mention that because that's what really touched off my notion of doing this podcast with you, because there are letters in the Faberback edition of the letters of Sylvia Plath that aren't in the hardcover editions, and there is no American paperback edition. Yeah.
Yeah,
So.
I think there are a total of 9 letters, if my memory's correct,
Yeah.
that we were able to sneak into the paperback edition. Some we were able to sort of put in, sort of chronologically where it should go because there was enough space on that page. And then some of them had to just be tucked in an appendix in
Yeah.
either volume. And so it's great that we were able to get those additional letters in there. And of course, there are 15 or 12 or 15 letters in the Harriet Rosenstein papers that we didn't get in time, and they obviously were made available a few months after the paperback came out. So eventually, one day, hopefully these will see the light of day in print. But until then, they're available in the archive, so that's great.
Yeah, I think Heather Clark quotes from them because she went to the archive. So you get bits and pieces, but it's not the same thing as having the whole letter. So yeah, that's important. Are you on the search for more letters, or is that stopped?
I'm never gonna stop. I have a couple of leads right now that I'm trying to chase up. But it's just one of those things where it's gonna be a time and a patience thing. But because I feel obligated to continue searching for the letters, because like I said earlier, I think a new and selected letters would be a really good book.
That's a good
And it
idea.
might be a way for the publishers to not take the letters of Sylvia Plath out of print, although that might very well happen, but to keep the letters available in some fashion. I mean, if you want to take it out of like physical print, that's fine, but hopefully they can just keep the Kindle editions or the electronic book editions
Yeah,
up
there's
to
no
date
reason they can't.
available.
Yeah, or yeah, print on demand, where if someone wants it on paper, they can get it.
Yeah. Well, I think there are going to be enough used copies out there that people could just get them used through Amazon or ABE Books. And I hate to think that people are selling them or not keeping them, but I get it. That's part of how reading and but the book world goes.
How many lost letters do you think there are?
I think there are probably still a couple of hundred. For example, this is nothing more than a gut feeling. I have no basis of there's nothing behind this. But I think, there are some Warren Plath letters in Letters Home, and we were obviously able to reproduce them in Letters of Sylvia Plath. But I don't think that that's everything. I think there are a couple of dozen more letters that Plath wrote, not only to Warren Plath, but to his wife, Margaret Plath. Because Plath did mention in some of her letters that we did publish that she did write to Maggie, as she called her. So And I think for Warren's privacy and Margaret's privacy and whatnot, he didn't want to share those in letters home. And I get that. But so I think whenever his estate is settled and the archival material is donated or sold or whatever to wherever it's going to go, then I think the world will find that, you know, there are a significant number of letters to Warren that weren't previously accessible.
I was just going to say there seem to be some things that are irretrievably lost, like class letters to Eddie Cohen.
Eddie Cohen, Richard Sassoon, the pre-1960 letters to Ruth Boischer. You know, I did keep track of the letters that she mentioned writing, and it's not a comprehensive list or even full or probably even accurate, because you know she talked about writing somebody one day and then she mentioned it again that she needed to do it the next day. So she didn't write them two letters, but she did mention it twice. So that's in my list twice. So it's kind of like it's a false hit sort of list. But that was 700 letters that list grew to. So, I mean, letters to Richard Norton as well. I mean, there must have been 300 letters to Richard Norton, because you can kind of extrapolate based on the number of letters that he wrote to her there at the Lilly Library, that there's probably at least one letter in reply to his. So that's one way to figure out a rough number of the letters that once existed but probably no longer exist. And that's frustrating, obviously, to a scholar or to a biographer or to a fan, no matter what the level of interest is or the level of engagement. That's rich information that's gone.
Yeah, and there's such nuances, especially with a subject like Sylvia Plath, you know, who she referred to herself to her sort of manic depression at times. It's almost like sometimes from day to day taking her temperature in a way. It can vary. So a missing letter, in a
It
sense.
does. Yeah.
Yeah, because you really want to see that. And even when one letter repeats another letter, you know, you need to look at who she's writing to,
Exactly.
because there are changes in tone. It's one of the things that drives me crazy about reviews of biography, and I think this is true in response sometimes to letters. People, even very sophisticated critics, often treat both biography and editions of letters as if they're just content. You know, that they're just telling a story. Why do we need that same story told again?
Well, because
Well,
it's
there are
never told the
parts
same way
missing.
twice.
Exactly. There are parts missing, and who tells the story and who she tells the story to can make a considerable difference in your estimation of the whole situation, like you were talking about Bell Jar. You know, assumptions about the last novel, you know, take on a different character. Now, I was listening to a critic, David Denby, the other day. I attended a conference on Norman Mailer, the critics who often disparage biography and say, well, it's only the work. He said something really interesting. He said, isn't that a kind of cop out? You know, to just sort of shove it aside as if the work has nothing to do with the life. That it's almost bizarre when you phrase it that way. So what should I have asked you? Anything that I've missed here that you wanted to talk about?
I don't really know. You know, if someone's really interested, I mean, they can do this if they have both letters home and the letters of Sylvia Plath. They could go through and examine some of the types of changes that were made, for example. And I've talked about this in a couple of the talks that I've given on the editing process. Like the first letter in Letters Home isn't really the first letter that Plath wrote from Smith. It was of the letter that she sent on her third day there. And the second letters in Letters Home contain mashups of two different letters that Plath had sent. So when anybody reads Letters Home, and I'm sure there is some value to keeping it on someone's bookshelf, it just needs to be taken with a grain of salt. It does drive me crazy when I read current scholarship and it cites either Letters Home or the abridged edition of the journals. It absolutely drives me bonkers, because those books have been replaced and there's almost no need for them, other than
They're only places in the history of the whole story,
yeah.
you know, how those books got made.
Right. And so, you know, there's probably, you know, the first volume came out 5 years ago this autumn. So it seems incredible that it's already been 5 years.
Yeah, I know.
And it in the lifespan, that's a ninth of how long there was Letters Home before we had the volume of the full volume. So 5 years is not a long time. And I don't know to what extent, still that the letters are being read or analyzed or used or worked with for various projects, but it's going to be kind of exciting to see what use of them people do make.
Yes.
I know that people have already used them, like Heather Clark obviously used them for her biography. You're going to be using them for your forthcoming volumes. A British scholar called Natalie Hirt used it, the Boyce letters for her P for her a thesis. So, I mean, they are being made immediate use of, which I think is wonderful. And so this sort of the sky's the limit now that they're out there. And I just
Yeah.
hope people, I hope they enjoy it.
Yeah, it really makes a difference. When I'm tracking parts of Plath's life and I'm looking at other sources, like there's a one volume edition of Ted Hughes's letters, so much left out. And again, we deal with the ellipses. It's almost like Letters Home. I don't know, you don't need to comment on this, but I'm going to say it. I don't know how Hughes scholars deal with that. I mean, they have to go to the archive for one thing, to get a fuller story. But that addition of the letters is, it just skews things.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of what Karen and I were sort of railing against when we were insisted on printing everything, because if you do a selected letters like that, it's not necessarily Ted Hughes raw. It's Christopher Reed's Ted Hughes,
Yeah.
or to what extent was Carol Hughes involved? To what extent did Faber even have for any input into the letters that were selected? So there are lots of sort of authorship, editorship questions that come into play with a selected edition of letters. I think with Letters Home, it's pretty clear that this was a sort of a family view of Sylvia Plath. You know, there are some nuances to that because obviously we know that Ted Hughes had final right of say for inclusion or exclusion and stuff like that. So,
Sure, yeah.
but with the Ted Hughes letters, I mean, I think Ted Hughes was a really good letter writer, but it's a disservice in a way not to have everything out there. And maybe it's because his handwriting's impossible. Nobody wants to deal with that. I know that when I read, I think other people, when they read his handwriting for too long, they develop eye strain and headaches and stuff like that because it is really difficult.
Yeah, the same is true with William Faulkner. He wrote in a minuscule hand, almost like he was writing in code for no one to decipher. There's the same problem with Faulkner. There's the selected letters, and it's appalling. I mean, it's better than nothing, I suppose. The problem is that the editor, Joseph Blattner, decided I'm only going to include things that really reveal something about Faulkner as a writer. What that does is it diminishes him as a human being. Yeah, in extraordinary ways, which is what I tried to rectify in my two-volume biography of Faulkner by, you know, going back to the archive. So yeah, I think that's an issue. I want to say one more thing before we close this off, and that is just the impressiveness of your work. And I'm not just talking about the letters of Sylvia Plath. I'm talking about decades of work in which you're not just finding things, you're telling us, look at what's missing.
Thank you.
There are gaps there. Sometimes a biographer can point that in a narrative, but you can't do it all in biography. You know, through what you've done online and your blog and so on, you're constantly, you know, well, when did she write that poem? That's crucial.
Yeah, thank you. I've always, I guess ever since I, you know, learned the internet back in 1997 or eight, I always wanted to, you know, when I realized that people around the world were interested in Plath and that there was a way to put the information out there for free through my website and then the blog, which I started in 2007, and even Twitter, it just seemed to me, why hoard the information? And why, you know, I didn't believe in that. And so it's been wonderful to share things with people who are like-minded and to know that it's been appreciated, I think. That's, you know, it's rewarding and it's kind of addictive too, because, you know, once you make one sort of, for lack of a better word, discovery or uncovery or recovery or whatever, it is like a drug. And I don't do it because people say thank you, which is wonderful. They're grateful. And that's kind of why I do it, because I know that it is being received gratefully and that it could be helping people sort of fill in missing pieces to whatever project it is they're working on. And that's kind of why I've gone after Plath holistically, both her writing and her life, because you can't exclude any part of it, because if you do, then you're not seeing the whole picture.
Yes, that's right. With the two volumes that I'm doing, one is in copy editing now, Sylvia Plath, right. Day by Day. It would have been impossible without your work, just impossible.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, it's just been terrific. So I guess we're going to call an end to this. I'm really grateful that no one started up their lawn equipment. They decided to do this on my back porch.
Well, it's a nice morning for it.
It is a nice morning for it. I can't bear to stay inside when I have this lovely screened-in porch and really a park-like setting, which I can only allude to for listeners, and it's a million-dollar view.
Nice.
Yeah, it is. So thanks for doing this, Peter. And I'm going to be doing this online on Facebook and Twitter, and I'll send you a link so you can post it as you wish as well.
Oh, great! Thank you, and thanks for having me on today. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's been a pleasure. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye, Peter.
Bye, Carl.